6. I caught TB there and have scars all over my lungs from the tuberculosis, and my brother and sister, two brothers and sister, both died of it, crib death and whatnot. And when I left Holy Cross in 46, I guess I was a Downriver Indian then, but I didn't make it back to Holy Cross or Keokuk until 35 years later. I guess when the state gets control of you, they have a way of lifting you up and away and into a world of their own. And I don't speak real good Indian, and my mother didn't want me to speak Indian. She told me, you don't speak Indian, Leonard, because if you speak Indian, you'll have an accent. And if you have an accent, you might get, you know, have a hard time. And we want you to not have to look like a native if you don't want to look like a native. Well, all these feelings and all these things which I, you know, remember and have been taught and experienced in living up here in a very brutal society have kind of had a religious overtone to me. And I remember being shuffled back and forth through all these foster homes and then finally being able to live with my mother. I remember sitting in Woodland Park here in 1950 and throwing nickels and dimes up on the railroad track and watching the railroad train run over them and crying, longing for my real mother because I'd been in so many foster homes after having had TB. And I remember they shipped me back to Fairbanks, and I got off the railroad train there, and there was my mother, and she embraced me, and she had alcohol on her breath. And, you know, it started making the wheels kind of click in my mind. Well, what was a life all about, and what was I doing here, and what was I? And so I started looking at religion very hard, and like going to the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church, you had to say the rosary, and well, you didn't have to, but they liked you to learn to say the rosary. And they had a lot of ritual, and they had these candle holders there, and they had a lot of organized meetings, and people were led to kind of believe all the same. But then I kept having these dreams and these fantasies inside of my head reoccurring. You know, like the Egyptian Sphinx, would flash into my mind like it was from outer space or something. You'd see a little red dot, and then it would get larger and larger and would bend. The light would bend as it raced toward my mind's eye through cosmic space. And Einstein used to talk about the rays of light bending as they travel through space, how matter influences particles, how particles influence space, now space influences the movement of particles. And I remember going to confession and confessing the most personal things that I would, on Friday night and to the Catholic priest. And when I got the opportunity to ask this priest, why was my mother an alcoholic, and what happened to my dad, my real dad, and why did these other people have all these nice cars and these nice homes, and what had I done to not get these things? And why did I want to have round eyes? And I found that the church really could not provide me with this inner happiness and this inner light that I had wanted. And but a strange thing kind of happened. I was kind of a hunter. I was one of the few kids around Fairbanks that would go out and set snares all the time. And I just hunted and trapped Fairbanks all around Fairbanks. Jimmy Huntington remembers. I was out at the airport one time trying to kill these muskrat, and he taught me how to call these muskrat in, and I killed it. I killed everything, and I was just an aggressive hunter. And I remember taking Chris Kiana out on a hunt back in 76, the 200th anniversary of this nation. And Chris has kind of turned into a good old boy. God bless him, and I love him. But he's been outside for so long now that he's adhered to another philosophy, and he is another person from another clan now, almost. And took him on this moose hunt. And I remember running up this hill, and I ran twice as fast as the rest of the guys. I've always been extremely athletic for some reason. And I closed my eyes to say this prayer. And I didn't want to shoot these animals because I wanted those two guys to shoot them. But when I said this prayer, I turned into a hunter, and I remember seeing these bull moose in my mind's eye, and this energy weaving between my mind's eye and these bulls, like this, kind of like an energy wave. And I opened my eyes at the end, after I prayed to this this great spirit, this unknown mystery in the cosmic universe, which I had just begun to feel in a very real sense as a native priest. I turned around, looked down that mountain, and I saw those two bulls looking at me just big as life, two big black bulls. Boy, I dropped that bull with one shot at 450 yards with iron sights on a downhill incline. And me and those Norwegian and that Chris, we packed those bulls out for 3 days after that. And the third day, I remember I was so hot and had such a pump in my upper body that I jumped into a cold creek. It was a lake at the east end of Crescent Lake, when you could hunt Crescent in those days, Crescent Lake down here. Wayne Racine used to fly me out there, and Flying Ned Zimmerman. They're both dead now because of air accidents. I remember that really kind of cooled my whole body down. I went back in to the lodge there at Moose Pass and rested, laid back and closed my eyes, and I can recall the Egyptian Sphinx racing through my mind's eye from a deep spot in space. And this red light appeared, and it would wave and get bigger and bigger. And then I could see the eyes of the Sphinx, which had been destroyed in the world's rendition out of Giza. The eyes peer through my very soul. You know, this is native religion. This is real religion. The Viking explorer, well, I had been telling this to people, you know, years ago. The Viking explorer discovered a large face carved in Egyptian form on Mars. And about 30 scientists seem to think that there are four huge pyramids around the sculpture, which is a mile high and 3/4 mile wide. Perhaps I'm not, but the bull moose is an integral part of Athabaskan Indian religion. It has the power in it just like the buffalo to the Plains Indians did, and I testify to that today. And I testify to the visions of Indian priests and to the sanctity of this land and to the enduring power that the mysterious forces that are in charge of this universe have given our line of priests and our religion. And I thank the Catholics for giving me religion in the first place, and love, and all of this. But at the same time, I realized that as natives, we are different, and that we have a right to our own religion, we have a right to our own land, and we have a right to our own culture. And there is no amount of money, there is no person in Congress that can ever take these things from us. And if they do try to take this land from us, woe be unto them. I've got to say.
Thank you, Mr. Winkow.
My name is Dorothy Bacolic. I'm from a small village of Shaktulik, and I'm speaking here today as a villager, even though I live in Anchorage currently. I'm opposed to the sale of stock, I'm opposed to the sale of land in any form, and I currently foresee loss of land if no amendments are made to the act. The solution that I feel would be most important to the villagers is education, because number one, the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act was a foreign concept to the villagers. And 14 years later, I think it's still a foreign concept to the villagers. It's a foreign concept to me. Our villages economically have always been dependent on bureaucracies to make decisions, to create jobs for anything. Bureaucracies such as BIA, school districts, state and federal governments. Now we have added AFN and our regional corporations as bureaucracies to the villages because we're used to having other people make decisions for us. there hasn't been enough education presented to the villagers, in my feelings, workshops and others just don't, they're just not adequate. They don't, you don't present all the issues to everybody from the village. You have to travel to the villages if you want them to know anything. The majority of our people are subsistence oriented, not business experts. That's where corporations are failing. That's where a lot of our corporations have failed. We're not business experts. We can go out and hunt, we can go out and do this, we can go out and do that, but business is a foreign concept too. I feel that our villages were treated with the passing of the Alaska Native Land Claims Act. It's true we got some money. It's true we got some land, but we also lost land that we had traditionally used for hunting, berry picking, whatnot. We got 115,200 acres. That's not all the land that we use.
That's your village.
Mm-hmm. We use more than that. Traditionally, we have always used more than that. But we had no say. We had no say when the Alaska Native Land Claims Act was passed. I was thinking of 1991 and remembering back to the time that easements were a threat to our land. At that time, the only explanation that we could come up with in the village that easements were a land for public use. And later on, we were presented with maps that showed all these different businesses that wanted plots of land. And that threw the people into a panic. It did, because it was something that we didn't understand, but we knew that these people wanted to come and take our land through easements. I'm glad we passed that, we survived that, but now we still have 1991 to come up with. I don't feel that we are equipped to deal with 1991 presently. We have corporations that are regionally that are losing money. We have corporations regionally, in the villages that are losing money. So when it comes time to, when they start taxing our land, I'm wondering where that money's gonna come from. Some people that I've talked with in the villages have, they want to explore traditional IRA councils to avoid taxation. That might be a solution, I don't know. What scares me about 1991 is that it could so easily happen, because the people in the villages, unless you have an instigator or somebody, an agitator come around, there's just not that much interest. People live day to day. Tonight, maybe somebody will want to go trapping or something. And, you know, if there's a meeting that night, they'll just say, I'd rather be out trapping, or I'd rather be out fishing, or I'd rather be out here. If you're gonna go and present workshops, you got to stay longer than 3 days or 1 day or a week, or just instead of just meeting with a corporate people, corporation directors, then I think that's where a lot of our villagers are being cheated, is that people come into the villages and they meet only with the corporate directors. And not enough of the people know about it. In the first place, we don't have copiers for the corporation directors to pass out notices to everybody. The next issue I wanted to address was should children born after 1991 be allowed to own stock? That's their birthright. I think it's bad because I was born after 1971 and I own stock, but those that were born after, you're just plumb out of luck. It's not fair to them. It's their birthright to own land and to own stock. And I see no reason why they can't. I don't care if my stock is cheaper in the end, but I think they have that right. That's all I had to say.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thomas Berger, I'm Isaac Kayutak, and everybody seems to be talking about birthrights. Now, my culture can talk about where the European culture came from. And there are a few people in here that have heard these same words I'm saying right now, and maybe they well wish not to acknowledge to those words, but the truth is my culture has talked about birthright ever since the language has been used by my people. Also, in my language, I can talk about three times when the North Pole changed its poles. And I know the Bible only goes back 10,000 years as far as history goes, maybe even less than 10,000. And when I talk with archaeologists and other technicians, these what we call natural disasters when our Earth changes their pole are in millions of years. Now, why is our birthright being contested by a very low form of government that does not even serve its people, only serves the system that just keeps taking instead of giving life? I do not want to be very racial, but has anybody ever asked, is the Tlingit a relative of the people that used to call themselves Aztecs and so on? But I am not here to talk about where we all came from. I am here to say I can talk about my land when the North Pole was in the South Pole, and before that it was in the North Pole, and before that back down in the South Pole. And the conditions that my language says we had to deal with was, one of them was darkness, where for many, many years, at one time when the earth flipped, people would, before going hunting in the dark, would lick their forearm and stick it out the door and stick it back in, and if it turned crystal white, it was a little too cold to go hunting. And we can talk about animals that had been called prehistoric animals by the scientists, how their habits were, their eating habits, their mating habits, and their behavior. Why I want to say these things is it's about time a lot of truth started coming out, not just, you know. I think it's very incomplete for my people just to talk about the last 100 years saying they are subsistence hunters. I know they are scholars, they're great historians, and they're better politicians, more honest, more effective. And they have always carried this on since Earth was populated by human beings. Now the Anglo-Saxon outlook and investigations on our people is very limited. I know that for a fact, because I have also been in Washington, D.C. I have been in Europe. I have also lived with my own people. You talk about experts who you say are professors and lawyers who have not even studied my language to its fullest extent to see what makes us talk like this, why we refuse to even talk about our history, because there's a lot of shameful things that even this commission would probably shut out. And these were talked to us by our elders, and a lot of it has not been printed because of security reasons. And like Dorothy said, 3-4 days is not enough in any one area. Why we talk like this is because, yes, we have lived with our people, and we have friends in urban areas who have educated themselves in the Anglo-Saxon way. They use the tools that are provided in urban areas. But we know that's not enough. And this commission should look more into our history way further back, like I had mentioned, and should thoroughly investigate it before submitting any kind of a report to the Inuit Circumpolar Conference. And if anybody else has anything else to add, I'm sure they will. But that's about all I can offer to your commission. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Bridger, I think it's probably be restful and important at this point to mention an effort that was made a while back to found a television show, news program, for the benefit of rural Alaskans by myself here a couple of years ago, which failed. And I want to know why it failed, and I think probably I should narrate its history as to what happened for the record. About 3 years ago, I realized that how fast times were changing and that we were on the threshold of a new era. Time is now moving so fast, you know, what with the space age and the development of mass communication, mass transit, computer medicine, computer research, that the people that I grew up with, and a lot of the people which got the education, I have a BA in history and a year and a half in law school, that got an education such as myself, really are having a hard time keeping up. So it appeared in my mind one day that if I formed a corporation to get a Native news show going, it would be a step in the right direction. So that's what I did. Oscar Quagley donated an office through my personal contact and a friendship with Oscar, who worked at the Calista Corporation. I got an office over there rent-free for a period of about 8 months. I went to RatNet, which is the Rural Alaska Television Network, and got an authorization to form a show on Sunday at 6:30, and it would be over the statewide F2 satellite. I went to AFN and got a resolution passed which endorsed the news show. I had to fight that resolution through AFN tooth and nail. And some of the leadership at AFN cursed me on the floor for trying to get that through. And I want to know why. And I want to know why I was not able to sell one penny's worth of advertisement to get a Native news show over the air. I did a show on it for Channel 7 in 1975 called Operation Santa Claus, and it won the station's Best Picture of the Year award. Yet I was not contacted when the award ceremonies were given. I was not contacted. It was judged at USC. But this was a statewide satellite network. You know, the fact that our Native people are being subjugated to national news, which comes out of largely owned Jewish networks, Reuters, API, UPI, the fact that the local news is interpreted and decimated and emphasized by certain business groups which own certain stations within the state. We don't have our group yet here. And it's my theory that we don't have that news decimation, that interpretive power, that selective power to give our Native people the news which they need. They need that news to survive in this space age. They need it, and they're not getting it, you see?
I think I agree with you, we need it, but the interest will be more on the small guy, because the TV is so new to the people that, wow, they can turn it on and they can watch small guy.
I would doubt that the Fall Guy would be more interesting than a news show which was orchestrated and developed by our own people that had been here for a generation or two. You know, you haven't seen that done yet, and this is something which needs to be done, and this is something which is a very important tool. I was talking with Willie Hensley about that, and he says, well, you know, Leonard, it probably failed because television is such a powerful tool.
There's a, this is not really having to do with ANCSA, but I conducted a commission, something like this in Canada in the 1970s, and the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation Northern Service established a team of Native reporters who traveled with me throughout the Northwest Territories of Canada. We went to all the Eskimo Indian villages and took testimony. And there was at that time only one radio and television network that reached the North. And they gave this group of broadcasters an hour on television, excuse me, an hour on the radio every night from 7 to 8. And they, because there are about 6 Native languages, there was a broadcast in English. There was one English language reporter for 10 minutes, and then 10 minutes to each of the Native languages. Maybe it adds up to more than 6, but it worked. They split up the hour, you know. Mm-hmm. And It's interesting. The first day that that broadcast began was March 3rd, 1975, the first day of hearings. And that was the first time there had been an hour devoted on the radio network that went throughout the North, a whole hour, really, in native languages. And the day we started, the City Council of Yellowknife, which is the capital, like Anchorage, only a lot smaller, passed a resolution. It was a 100% non-native council, passed a resolution deploring the use of an hour of radio time for native language broadcasting. But the broadcasting network stayed with the program for about 2 years that hearings went on, and in fact gave range to give them 10 minutes on television every night, which they used one night in English, one night in Slavey, one night in Inuktitut, one night in Dogrib. And that was the beginning, really, of large-scale native language broadcasting in the Arctic and subarctic regions of Canada, and now they have their own, the native people have their own network that piggybacks on the commercial satellite. And it is being studied by native groups in other countries. It seems, you know, to be something that's working, and you might be interested in following that up. Regarding the, you know, I know there's always a tendency to look for conspiracies out there when something doesn't turn out the way you had hoped. But this type of thing is being done in some places, and it seems to be working there. Anyway, in fact, there is somebody who's here. Marie Wilson is here from Yellowknife, and she is she isn't here right now, but she's making a program for the Northern Network about what I'm doing in Alaska, you know. And if she's around town for a few days, you might be worthwhile for you to speak to her and find out more about that. She knows more about it than I do. I kind of lost touch with it 6, 7, 8 years ago, but I think it's doing all right.
Well, in as much as we had a resolution passed to AFN trying to get this thing going, and it didn't work, it would be a timely thing now, especially with the claims and all that's happening. It you know, it's way past due.
Thanks. Well, I thought we might take a break now for a bit. It's 5 o'clock, and we'll carry on through to 8 o'clock, but I think we'll take a fairly solid break, and I think I'm going to slip out for a sandwich. I know the organizers will disapprove of this, but I'd like to do that, and we'll come back later and carry on for a while. Let's say come back 5:30-ish. Okay? Did you want to say something before we stop? Oh, okay. Hi.
Is your name Burgess?
Yes, right.
Yes, and my name is Ronald Young. I'm from Port Graham.
Right, well, wait a minute. Are we all set, Jim?
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
I was born and raised in Port Graham for 8 years, but my dad, he moved us to Casillo Ferry. And I grew up in Casillo for about 8 years, and I moved from there and went on my own. And I didn't hear, you know, I thought of the Alaska Native Land Claims Act as something to benefit myself, some kind of heritage to hold me and myself, or me and my people in the background, something to hang on to during the future. And one of the curious things about the 1991 Resolution Act that I see, and this is how I see it as an individual myself, is that it's a promotion to sell. Mm-hmm. Sell the stock. There's no benefit for the individual native, especially the elder. As a matter of fact, I think it's trying to demolish the elder and his teachings to the younger people. And my concern is that when they come up with this 1991 resolution, as I am only 32 years old, going on 32, is that if I sell my stock to these people, which I looked at before, was that how much power would these executive people have? Because they asked for the first option to buy. One of the problems that I've confronted before during talking with these corporate members is that they could vote any way they want to. They don't need the individual's vote themselves. They make the decision on themselves by amending and enacting policies within their corporation and their organization. And it denies the individual native shareholder the right to get up there and talk. And this is one of the things that I've confronted within the last 14 years. And I think it's the 99-1 resolution is a promotion just to sell and give the corporate executive director the power to do whatever he wants to do with the land and the investment that they make on the land. I think it's inaccurate, and I don't think that they have the right to present something like this, because they denied everybody, even before when they passed it in 1971, as I understand it through the chief of my village, there was less than 300 people there. And they didn't.
That's Port Graham.
Yes, it is. And the chief of my village had fought for, back in 68 and 69, had fought to put Port Graham on the map. And to this day right now, as he went to the AFN convention this last year of 84, he stated that he felt he ripped off the younger people of their rights, the people that haven't been born. And he felt that he didn't know that this would resolve this way, that this would would happen to land and to his people. And my basically fight right now, I didn't want to get into the politics of this situation here, but I find out that now I have to get into the politics to fight for my own rights. And one of the things is that I was trying to get a job through my corporation, and I was denied a job because of lack of experience, and because that I have not had the right training for the job, which is, you know, I would think that it's kind of irrelevant right here to this talk, my saying right here. But the important part is that there is a lot of large number of natives that are in the same boat as I am. I understand when I read books like Alaska Rural Development and Alaska's Native Self-Determination and their own government, I understand that the Alaska Native Land Claims Act was set up as a vehicle for natives to move into this caste-based economy, this caste-based society here. It was set up for that, to provide them with jobs, income, subsistence. We always end up going back to our old ways of life and finding now that we can't compete with these people because we haven't had the right training. Yet it was too fast for us to have the training for us. It was too fast. It happened all within 14 to 15 years that we now learn that, hey, this economy here is moving way too fast for us to try to keep up with it. Our younger people right now are trying to educate themselves on this native land claims issue and everything about natives. They're just now getting into the move of it. It took us 15 years for them to get into the move of it. How do they expect us to do something within 20 years? And I see it as the corporate board members that first took over, they lost interest because they knew what it was about. They knew that this income that they had coming to them would turn them, make them be bought out. In other words, sell the other native for yourself. That's the way I see it. 1991 resolution is coming on that way. I didn't really accept Willie Hensley's article, a statement that he put in the Anchorage Times paper about a month ago. He stated that we, the people, for 300 years has been robbing and ripping off the land. I don't know about him, but myself, for 14 years, he could go back 14 years and say that, but not 300 years. I think the individual natives have been doing something to provide for themselves, which they knew from the beginning. Subsistence, not rip off people. Now for 14 years, he could go back 14 years and make his statement as that. The way I feel about the 1991 resolution, it's a promotion to shell. And I'm scared of the other native, to trust the other native, because he might be the person that want to take advantage of me. And the one that I'm most scared of most is the corporate native. He's going to take advantage of me, other people I know. And I'm not really happy about what has happened over the 14, 15 years that went by. I know that for some of the people here, to talk to another corporate member within your corporation, it's hard because you don't have the money to go around and tell them, hey, these people are doing this, they're doing that, they're ripping you off. And since 1971 started and their meetings, people did speak up, but they weren't heard. They were told to shut up. It was none of their business. And I tried to speak up last year to my corporate board members, and I told them, I said, listen, this is not right. What you're doing is wrong. I said I had no business. I had no interest in this. I had no right to make my claims as I did, but yet for 2 years I was promised employment, but never got the employment until I filed a complaint. And now they're saying it's my fault. I'd like to know who's ripping off who. That's all I have to say.
Thanks very much.
Mr. Bergeron, Commission. I am Karen McClellan, a shareholder of NANA and KIC Corporation from Kotzebue. There are two areas of a particular issue that I want you to address for me and that I would like publicly recognized. First, in February of 1984, I was contracted by Alaska Attitudes of Anchorage to conduct the ANCSA study surveys in the NANA region. Alaska Attitudes was subcontracted under Northwest Attitudes of Portland and under BIA Fairbanks and MCI out of Virginia. In a move to gain more monies to pay approximately 20 of us Alaskans for conducting the surveys in 42 or more villages throughout Alaska, Alaska Attitudes lost the contract altogether. Therefore, to the best of my recollection, there are five interviewers whom have not been paid to date, including myself. We are pursuing the possibility of filing a class action suit against Ed Phelps of MCI or against the party found legally responsible for this predicament, that being breach of contract. My questions for you to answer now or in letter to me are as follows. Do you have any suggestions or advice on an appropriate avenue to take in regard to gaining legal action and or justice in this area? And whom would be able or willing to help me gain knowledge on similar situations that have occurred and what has been done to resolve them?
Well, I can't advise you about legal remedies in Alaska. What I suggest you do is go down to Legal Services and you might talk to Dave Florey there and I'm sure he'd be happy to give you some advice on the subject.
Okay. Are you aware of any similar situations that have happened and what has been done to resolve these?
Well, I'm afraid that when that kind of thing has happened, Alaska or any place else, people usually, when you say they, that you and some other people haven't been paid, if there's no other remedy, then about all you can do is go to legal services. They weren't an employer. You were really an independent contractor. That's all I can suggest.
Okay. Secondly, MCI contracted ESG out of Fairbanks to finish the ANCSA study surveys in the state. This is my main point here. I have vague knowledge about how efficiently and thoroughly ESG conducted and finished those surveys in Alaska. I have personal knowledge about who redid the interviews again in the Nana region and whether or not all villages that were intended to be surveyed were in fact surveyed. Now, it is my understanding that 2 out of 3 villages in our region, in the Nana region, were not surveyed at all. I also know, mostly from what I read in the ANCSA study draft section on the surveys, about how efficiently Anchorage interviews were done. Due to many factors, many interviews were excluded. I'm most certain that due to time factors, many regional surveys were not done, or that they were not done as best as they could have been. Now, consequently, although MCI wished to represent 2% of the native population of Alaska in these surveys, my speculation suggests that they will be representing a very minute percentage of us in that final product. What upsets me the most is the fact that the final draft of the 1985 ANCSA study, with its possible defective section of surveys, will be on its way to Congress come June. And that leaves no time to redo any studies that have been.